what you are basically. Deep, deep down, far, far in, is simply the fabric and structure of existence itself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
Honestly expressing yourself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
The fabric and structure of existence.
Hi everybody, welcome to the Parallel Mic podcast, episode number 52, which marks the 1 year anniversary of the podcast. So a very big thank you to everyone who has subscribed, liked and shared the podcast over the past year, and especially to the members who have joined me over on parallelmic.com to support the show and listen to the full episodes. I appreciate everyone's support and I look forward to another year together, educating ourselves, speaking to some fantastic guests, and boy, we've had some great guests over the past year, but I've got plenty more lined up, so I look forward to that, so thank you again. Now, for episode number 52, I wanted to share an episode that I've been thinking about for some time, and that is an exploration into the surname and how that relates to the Roman and maritime law matrix and our place within it, which is why I titled this one, What's in a Name? Now, for those that have no idea what I am talking about, fear not, because we're going to be breaking it all down in tonight's episode. But one thing I have to say before we get started is that of all the things I've researched over the years, this is without a doubt one of the most difficult to find good quality information. Most of the good research is censored, meaning that what is readily available is actually mostly disinformation, and there's plenty of scammers out there claiming to be legal gurus putting out content. Some of it's okay, but oftentimes it's mixed in with a lot of misinformation and disinformation. So I've really struggled to put this one together, and it's definitely going to be a speculative episode, but I have found some fantastic people where I think the information is extremely good quality. So let's treat this one as an investigation, and I'm not going to tell you what to think about it. I just want you to be open-minded, go into it with an open mind like I did, and see what you think by the end of the episode. Now, I can tell you already that I'm going to get a load of emails after this one, because whenever I discuss maritime law and how it's being used to gamers and trappers in the system of debt slavery, I always have at least a few people reach out and ask me to speak to their chosen guru on the podcast and discuss these subjects. But you really have to be very careful when it comes to these self-styled legal gurus, because oftentimes they're promising people that they can teach them how to not pay for their debts, how to not pay taxes, not pay energy bills. And you know, because the legal system is so confusing, they always attract a big following, because oftentimes people can't make sense of it themselves. The legal system is extremely confusing. It is deceptive by nature, and lots of the words don't even mean what we think they mean. They have a separate special legal meaning, as you're going to find out tonight. So oftentimes when I hear these people speaking, they speak very authoritatively, but when I look into them and look into what they're truly saying, actually, they turned out to be scammy as hell, and they really didn't have much clue what they was doing. So that's why I wanted to do this episode, because it is important and it could really help some people. But like I said, just be careful, because there's lots of people out there professing to know this kind of stuff, telling people they can get away with all sorts, and those people end up in prison. There's been many people in the UK, for example, who thought they could get out of paying their council tax and their energy bills, and then they were shocked when the energy company turned up at their house with the police. The police kicked down the door and they came in and replaced their meter with a smart meter. That's actually happening. So this is no joke. This is no joke. But on the other hand, I have met some people and spoken to them privately, and they truly are picking apart the maritime law system when it comes to ownership, property rights, and ultimately turning themselves from debtor within the system back to creditor. So without a doubt, the legal system is of huge importance. It's an important rabbit hole that we must go down, because the reality is we are being trapped in a Roman law system. And I've highlighted this in a number of episodes, so you can go back and listen to episode number 34, The Crown is the Only Absolute Owner of Land, and episode number 30, which is called The Corporation Who Owns the World. These are must-listen-to episodes if you want to understand how your property rights are being stolen from you. But how is it being done? That is the question, and that's why I want to get to today. Why is it that you don't get to own your land absolutely, but someone like the King or Queen of England does? Why do you need a passport to travel and a driver's license, and yet they can drive a car without any license? They can cross borders with no passport. They don't pay any taxes, but you do. Why is it that they are sovereign legally and you are not? That's what I want to get to tonight, because what's happening is your natural God-given rights are being usurped and it's being replaced. And it's being replaced because a legal fiction is being created, which they are using to tax to apply all of these debts to. Now, you might have heard some of this stuff before, but you also probably thought, well, it sounds a little bit weird. It sounds a little bit scammy. It doesn't sound legit. Well, that's what we're going to look at tonight. We're going to go into it with an open mind, and I want to make a case for the idea that you are actually being turned into a legal entity, much like a corporation, and that is how your natural rights are being usurped. So this is going to be a deep dive episode. We're going to really pick apart the subject, and I'm going to lay out what I think is happening, and it's not the same as what other people say on this one. So it's going to be a very interesting episode. Stick with me on it, and I look forward to hearing your comments. Members, please head over to parallelmind.com to listen to the full episode. Everyone else, please consider joining us. This is a fantastic one to jump into the full episode. So I'm really excited to get started. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you're all well, healthy, and reasonably happy. And like always, I'll see each and every one of you in the next one for episode number 53. Okay, everyone, let's get to it. We're going to start with a quote, and this is about the surname. A surname is a name born hereditarily by all members of a family, usually in a male line descent. In Anglo-Saxon times, people had a personal or given name only, and owing to the paucity of these four names, had to be distinguished by an additional byname or two name, which may have been an occupation, a reference to a parent called patronymic, a nickname, or an association with a place. These are all categories that later developed into hereditary surname. So all it's saying there, everyone, is that to begin with, back in time, before Anglo-Saxons, people actually didn't have a last name. There was no surname. It was formed later on for reasons we're going to be asking about in this episode. But prior to that, what we actually had was people only having a Christian name. The Christian name was the only name, but people were often then given another name that was used to distinguish them from other people who might have had the same name. So for example, it could have been Nick Blacksmith, John Carpenter. Now, why would it have been that? Well, of course, people lived in much smaller locations, so it might have been a village or a town at best. So naturally, there wouldn't have been many people with the same Christian name because people were living in much smaller communities. Now, it could have been the profession of the person, like I said, or it also could have been the location where they was from. So maybe they went to another town, then it might have been Mike from Brough. So it might have been Mike Brough or Mike from Liverpool, Mike Liverpool. That's how it would have been done back then. Now, there was many, many other ways to name a person too. Sometimes it was based on a personal trait. It could have been the name of an animal even. It could have been Mike Dodgy Eye. It could have been something like that. They literally had thousands of ways of naming a person. But essentially what mattered was your genealogy. So they try and figure out who a person was from. That is why the Bible starts off with these long, long lineages. That was the most important part. And that's why Genesis is really taken up with just tons of genealogies. We've got Adam, we got Seth, we got Enosh, we got Kenan, Malahel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, on and on it goes. Genesis is actually very boring when you get to those bits, but it's extremely important. If it wasn't, it wouldn't have been there. And what they wanted to do was trace the bloodline. The bloodline was the most important bit, not the last name. The last name was not included. But what they would sometimes say was Adam's son. Mike is Adam's son. That's why you got the last name later on. Adamson, Jefferson, Thomason, Thompson. It was always coming from that genealogy. You were somebody's son. So when people had to start picking last names, they said, well, I'm Adam's son, so I'll be Adamson. That'll be my last name. That's why so many last names have this in them. So let's continue the quote. Legally, one's given name, and only the first one was recognized, was immutable in former times, and one could take, be given, or change one's surname at will. This state of affairs was not quite extinct even in 1859, but by the 19th century, surnames had become a more certain identifier for the simple reason of numbers. There were roughly 600 given names, but some 20,000 surnames. Nowadays, it is the combination of given names and surname that distinguish an individual. Surnames started to become fixed in most of Central and Western Europe at about the same time, that is, from the 12th century onwards. It is therefore not surprising to find that the earlier surname types were largely patronymic, with differentiating locality names both being major contributors to the stock of current surnames. Hereditary surnames were first introduced into England by some of the leading followers of William the Bastard, and most were derived from the place names of their estates, either in France or in England. These surnames were important to show continuity of ownership of property and were usually only inherited by the eldest son. The possession of a surname became a sign of Gentile birth, and it was deemed a disgrace for a gentleman to have but one single name, as the meaner sort had. So I just want to pause there a second again, because what I want people to understand is that the introduction of the surname was actually done for property rights. It was so that the people who had come along with William the Conqueror and stolen all of the lands, and remember I did an episode on this, number 34, the crown is the only absolute owner of land. They came to England in the 1200s, they took all of the land which was held allodially by the citizens, and they said, now we own it. And it was actually the king that said, I own all of it, but he gave some of that land to the people who helped him conquer Great Britain. Now, they wasn't too happy, having done all of this warring and conquering, to have that land held in the name of the king. And of course, that's where the title comes from. The crown is the only absolute owner of land. And still today, in Great Britain, the crown is the only absolute owner. So they thought, well, we want our rights. We want our property rights. And that is where the surname came in. So they started to add to their name also the place where they owned land. So for example, the Duke of Edinburgh, the Duke of Buccleuch, wherever their land was held, they would create a title that said of that place. And that was where the surname came in. Now, it wasn't actually a surname. It was the land. It was the place where they was. But they adopted that as their surname to show continuity of ownership of the land, because they was terrified of having that land taken from them. That is where the Magna Carta came from. It was them trying to ensure and enshrine their rights versus the king. And most of English history has been this, the elites trying to ensure that the king or the queen doesn't take their land and property off them. It was never about us. The Magna Carta was never for you and I. It was for the elites trying to get their rights enshrined. It had nothing to do with us. Now, I see a lot of the legal gurus talking about the Magna Carta and how our rights go back to the Magna Carta. Not quite true. In America, there is a lineage, of course, from the Magna Carta all the way to the Declaration of Independence, but the Magna Carta never once discussed you or I. It discussed only the people that were associated with the king, the noblemen. That was it. So I just wanted to make that one clear. But that's where the surname started to come in. They were using it as elites to show their property right ownership. It's related to commerce. It's related to money. It's related to property rights and ownership. And later on, the surname started to get adopted en masse for much the same reasons. Although by this time, it wasn't to show who owned what, it was to show who owed what. The custom of applying a man's by name to all of his children began in the late 12th century and spread slowly, with the manorial classes of the south of England leading the way. The first legal recognition of a hereditary surname is found in 1267. It was de Canterbrig, meaning of Canterbury. By 1400, three quarters of the population are reckoned to have borne a hereditary family name, and the process was completed by about 1450 in England. Now, when you think about it, everyone, the way of doing things now with the surname is not that efficient. People might be thinking, oh, this was all about efficiency. But let's just pause for a second. In today's world, how many people do you think there are with the last name Smith, for example? There could be 10, 20, 40, 50 million people with the name Henry Smith or John Doe, whatever it is. But in the old system where you did the genealogy, how many people would there have been where it was Mike, son of John, son of Paul, son of James, son of Peter? If you go back just a few generations, it's extremely unlikely that somebody would have the exact same combination of names as you if they came from a different family. Now, of course, maybe you was unlucky, maybe you've got the same name as somebody else and you had the same father's name and the same grandfather's name. But eventually, if you go back further and further, you'll get to the point where you no longer have the same names. It's impossible that you would have all the same names as somebody else. That is why it was used. That's why it was so damn important to them to keep track of the lineages very precisely, because it was your unique code showing which bloodline you came from and who you came from. So it was a very, very precise way of doing things. Today is actually much less precise. The way we do it today, we could be mixed up with many different people. So it's certainly not about efficiency. That's what I'm getting at. It was done for another reason. So we have to make sense of what that reason might have been. And the clue is actually how it first began to be used, which was to identify who had some property. So there was a financial element to it. So now maybe listeners would like to guess, where do you think the surname first started to be used en masse in Europe in the 1400s? You guessed it. It was in the Italian city-states, the same place where we saw the Medici Bank and the Vatican Mafia and all of the other banking oligarchies where they came from. They started to employ the surname, but it wasn't to show who owned what. It was actually because they wanted to start taxing each and every citizen. They wanted them to pay tithes or tributes or taxes, and they wanted a register of where everybody was so they could tax them. Now, my next quote is going to really lay this one out, so listen to this one. Ashkenazic Jews were among the last Europeans to take family names or surnames. Some German-speaking Jews took last names as early as the 17th century, but the overwhelming majority of Jews lived in Eastern Europe and did not take last names until compelled to do so. The process began in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1787 and ended in Tsarist Russia in 1844. In attempting to build modern nation states, the authorities insisted that Jews take last names so that they could be taxed, drafted, and educated in that order of importance. For centuries, Jewish communal leaders were responsible for collecting taxes from the Jewish population on behalf of the government, and in some cases were responsible for filing draft quotas. Education was traditionally an internal Jewish affair. So there you have it, everyone. I just want to pause there. There you have it. That is why the Ashkenazic Jews did not want to take the last name, because they understood what it meant. And remember, they were the money lenders. They were the ones who were allowed to practice usury. So they were pretty clued up on the financial side of things, and they understood that the last name had nothing to do with your family. The surname was all about big state and government. It was about the maritime law, the Roman law system. It was putting you in the system so you could be taxed, so that your property could be registered. So they refused to do it, and they actually had to be compelled to do it. And I can't help but think that this is probably, if you look deep enough, and if you peel back enough layers, this is probably one of those narratives that we don't hear about. But I imagine when Jews were being expelled from certain countries, it was probably also at times related to things like this, them refusing to put themselves in the system. And of course, all of these kings and queens that were building these empires, they wanted people in the system. They wanted to tax people. And if you can't tax somebody, well, then you don't want them in the country. It's similar to the US. If you don't want to be taxed by the US, now you have to renounce your citizenship. It's almost like in ancient Rome, where they used to condemn people to exile and make them persona non grata, which I'll come back to in a little bit. But I think this quote here is extremely valuable because it tells us what the last name was actually used for. People did not have a last name. They had a first name, a Christian name, or legally speaking today, we call it the proper name. And the last name was all about taxation, finance, and putting you into the system. And the Ashkenazic Jews clearly didn't want to be put in the system, so they refused to take a name until they was forced to. Until this period, Jewish names generally changed with every generation. For example, if Moses, son of Mendel, Moshe ben Mendel, married Sarah, daughter of Rebecca, Sarah bas Rivka, had a boy and named it Samuel, Shmuel, he would be called Shmuel ben Moshe. If they had a girl and named her Feigela, she would be called Feigela bas Moshe. Jews distrusted the authorities and resisted the new requirement. Although they were forced to take last names, at first they were only used for official purposes. Amongst themselves, they kept their traditional names. Over time, Jews accepted their last names, which were essential as they sought to advance within the broader society. The easiest way for Jews to assume an official name was to simply adapt the name they already had, making it permanent. This explains the use of patronymics. Patronymics, son of. In Yiddish or German, it would be son, or son, or heir. In most Slavic languages, like Polish or Russian, it would be vich or vitz, anglicized to wick or witz. For example, the son of Mendel took the last name Mendelssohn. The son of Abraham became Abramson or Abramovich. The son of Manash became Manashvitz. The son of Itzak became Itzavitz. The son of Kessel became Kessler, and so on and so forth. So if you want to know why the Jewish community has lots of interesting and quite strange last names, now you know why. It's because when they were first asked to take last names, they did not take it very seriously. Many of them to begin with thought that these last names would only ever be used for official purposes, so they would choose interesting and strange ones. Similar to the old last names that I mentioned before, where people were talking about animals or strange characteristics of a person or what they like to do. For example, you'll know lots of Goldbergs and Goldsmiths, names like this relating to money. So that's how a lot of it started, but over time they actually got saddled with these names and they had to keep them, and then they probably changed them and slightly altered them. But remember, what we're talking about here is they had to take them. They were forced to take them to put them in the system. It was not by choice, and they wanted to put them in the system so they could tax them. Okay, so now let's just take a step back and go back to ancient Rome, because that's where Roman law, otherwise known as maritime law, came from. And what I'm talking about when I say maritime law is the law of merchants. That's where our legal system comes from. It's Roman law that we are under. It is not common law. It's certainly not natural law, which is where common law is derived from. So let's try and find out how the Romans were using names in their legal system, because our law today derives directly from Roman civil law. So I want to understand how they was using it. Then we'll take a look at Black's Law Dictionary to try and find out how our name is understood legally today. But first, let's go to the source. Let's go back to ancient Rome. The Greeks, as it is well known, bore only one name, and it was one of the especial rights of a father to choose the names for his children and to alter them if he pleased. It was customary to give the eldest son the name of the grandfather on his father's side. The day on which children received their names was the 10th after their birth. The 10th day, called Denate, was a festive day, and friends and relatives were invited to take part in a sacrifice and a repast. If in a court of justice proof could be given that a father had held the donate, it was sufficient evidence that he had recognized the child as his own. Among the Romans, the division into races and the subdivision of races into families caused a great multiplicity of names. They had the first, the pronomen, which was proper to the person. Then they had the nomen, which meant belonging to his race. They also had a surname or cognomen, designating the family, and sometimes an agnomen, which indicated the branch of that family in which the author had become distinguished. Thus, for example, Publius Cornelius Scipio Africanus. Publius is the pronomen, the first name, Cornelius the nomen, designating the name of the race Cornelia, Scipio the cognomen or surname of the family, and Africanus the agnomen, which indicated his exploits. Okay, so why is this so important to understand? Well, of course, like I said, it's because Roman maritime law is literally the legal system that we have today. So we need to understand the origins of these names so we can then move on to understanding how they are understood, legally speaking, today. Because we know for a fact that today we are not being ascribed our God-given natural rights, our creator-given rights. Therefore, there is something that has happened to us that has put us in a legal system and created a legal construct for us. And I think we're getting somewhere. So that's where we're going to go to next. But you just have to remember what the Roman maritime law system is. That's why we've got all of these words that we use today. That's why we call it a birth certificate, because it was all based on sailing around the world and being merchants. So when you put your ship into a dock, you had to have a certificate of the birth. The birth is where the boat goes. So now you know why we have language like this around finance that is all related to water. We call it a currency. Of course, that relates to the current of a river or the current of water. Why do we call financial institutions banks? Well, of course, the banks contain the currency. Banks of a river, currency, water. Banks, currency. What happens if you become insolvent? We call it going bankrupt. The rupture of the banks, that means the currency has overflowed, something has gone wrong. It's also why we might say if somebody is struggling financially that they are swimming in debt, or they are just keeping their head above water, or they are just staying afloat. We talk about things like the flow of money. We call the flow of money liquidity. Again, all water terms. You can have your bank account frozen. Again, that is a water term. So now you're seeing it, now you're understanding all of these terms come from maritime law. And what they essentially did was they took the law of the maritime world and applied that to our world. They actually accept the law of the land, and they did this so that they could force upon us their legal system and take away our natural God-given rights to remove natural law and replace it with man's law, which is of course maritime law. So now you know why we call it ownership when we have property. Ship, of course, is a maritime word. We call it ownership. And that's why you come out of the birth canal. That's why you say your mother's water has broken. The waters break and then you come down through the birth canal. Then you get the birth certificate. That is literally describing a maritime system. You take your ship, you go through the canal, you go into the birth, and then you come out with the birth certificate. And the birth certificate lists the goods that were being transported by the vessel, by the ship, which in this instance, metaphorically speaking, is your mother. Now, of course, you and your mother, you are not things, you are not ships, you are not objects, you are not goods, you are not vessels, you are human beings and you were created by God. And when you come into this world, when you are born because God created you. Therefore, you have God-given rights, inalienable rights, which means they cannot be taken by anyone. However, if you have those natural rights accepted because you willingly or unknowingly are put into the legal system, the maritime law or the Roman civil law system, then of course you don't get those natural rights. You now have to participate in their system. And therefore you can be taxed. You have all of these laws that can be applied to you, fines that can be put upon you. And they have to put you in the legal system. They have to create a legal construct for you because without the legal construct, none of those things can be done. Okay, so we're getting somewhere now. So now let's go to Black's Law Dictionary to see if this theory, and it is just a theory now, actually holds any weight. Of course, we've got a premise, a very good one, because I've showed you the history of the surname. But let's actually now fast forward to the legal dictionary to see how these things are working today. And we're going to begin with those Roman names that I just discussed, the pronomen, the cognomen. Let's start there and see if they are in Black's Law Dictionary. Now, for those that don't know, Black's Law Dictionary is literally the book that all lawyers have to go to find out the true meaning of words. And the words in Black's Law Dictionary, when you look at them, they might seem familiar. However, in the legal sense, they have very different meanings. There is also a lot of Latin because, of course, that's what the original laws were written down in. And all of this is derived from Roman law. So you need to understand Black's Law Dictionary is not some speculative book. It is the authority when it comes to the legal system and defining what the words that are used in a court of law actually mean. Now, it doesn't actually matter if those words have other meanings outside of the courtroom. Within a courtroom, they can only ever mean what the definition states in Black's Law Dictionary. Now, that's extremely important, and it's also extremely deceptive. Because if I go into a court of law and I, for example, answer that this is my name, well, what if name means something else than what I think it means? And you're going to find out it actually does. But first and foremost, let's go to those Roman terms. Then we will go to modern day terms. And I'm going to lay out just how deceptive and tricky it is to truly understand what your true name is and what your artificial name is. Cognomen, in English law, a surname, a name added to the nomen proper or the name of the individual, a name descriptive of the family. In Roman law, a man's family name. The first name, prenomen, was the proper name of an individual. The second, nomen, indicated the gens or tribe to which he belonged, while the third, cognomen, denoted to his house or family. The agnomen was added on account of some particular event as a further distinction. So this is from Black's Law 6th edition that I'm quoting, and I use the 6th edition because it retains a lot of the Latin and Roman law and also adds a lot of the case law denoting to which cases these things can be looked up to find out how they were used in a court of law. A lot of that was taken out later on. That's why I stick with the 6th. Now, in the definition for cognomen, it's actually very interesting. It says that that's a surname and it was a name added to the nomen proper. And it says the nomen proper or the prenomen was the proper name of the individual, meaning that was their actual name. The cognomen was only ever an addition. And of course, it says there were other potential additions that could be used, like the gnomon and also the ad gnomon, which denoted to things like their tribe or to give them some kind of indicator for a further distinction. But the pre-gnomon was actually the proper name. Again, your Christian name is your name. Your first name is who you are. That's the natural person. What separates you from the natural person is the cognomen or the other names that are added to it. Okay, let's go back to Black's Law Dictionary. Prenomen, the first or Christian name of a person. Prenomen, forename or first name, the first of the three names by which the Romans were commonly distinguished. It marked the individual and was commonly written with one letter, as A for Aulus, C for Caius, etc. Nomen, in the civil law, a name, the name, style or designation of a person. Properly, the name showing to what gens or tribe he belonged, as distinguished from his own individual name, the prenomen, from his surname or family name, cognomen, and from any name added by a way of descriptive title, agnomen, the name or style of a class or genus of persons or objects. And listen to this, this is the last line of definitions for nomen in Black's Law Dictionary 6th edition. The name or style of a class or genus of persons or objects, a debt or a debtor. So gnomon can actually be used to classify somebody as a debtor. That is extremely interesting. Now, could it be? That is why we are on the hook for all of the governmental debt that is lent and loaned into existence by the central bank, which is borrowed at interest, and then we must pay it back because we are put into the system as debtor. So could it be that they have managed to turn our last name into the gnomon? Something to think about, and we'll come back to it later. Now, one more thing that I wanted to comment on is when I looked up the definitions of cognomen, of prenomen, and also of nomen, in the Black's Law Dictionary, all of them had the letters L-A-T dot just after the word, meaning it derives from Latin. All of them except for cognomen. After cognomen, it simply says in English law. Now, that's extremely interesting because I can't help but think that was not an oversight, which leads me to believe that cognomen, if it was used, it was known by a different name. So we just don't know. Is the word cognomen truly derived from Latin, like the other terms? Was it even used in Roman law? Or was it actually a later addition? Because it simply says cognomen in English law, whereas all the other ones have Latin after it. Very interesting. Again, could be a deception, could be a way of getting us to adopt the surname and use it in a fashion that turns us immediately into the debtor once we adopt it. And of course, we adopt it immediately after birth. When we come out of that birth canal, we get our birth certificate and it's signed immediately. And they put upon that a last name. And that last name, of course, is written in all capital letters, which simply has no precedent in the English language. And remember, legal language is extremely precise. Every single comma, every single article, every single capitalization is scrutinized. Everything has to be precise in legal language. So there is no precedent for capitalizing the last name. However, on legal documents, on your birth certificate, on your driver's license, it is being capitalized. The only time we actually capitalize a name is for corporations. So I just want you to take a step back and think about what's happening here. So now we're going to go back to the legal dictionaries and we're going to look up some terms to get their definition. Terms like legal person, artificial person, corporation. And that will hopefully give us some more insights as to how our last name is working in a legal sense today, and how the law sees us. Now, this is where it gets very interesting, but before we look up the legal definition for the term legal person, let's just first and foremost look at the etymology of the word person, because I think that will be useful. Then we'll get back to the legal dictionary to look up the term legal person, because I want to understand what that means in a legal sense. Person. The word person has multiple meanings. It is etymologically derived from personare, a term related to historianalis larva, which means mask. In this sense, the person is understood as the mask covering the face of the actor who recites verses during a scene in a play. The mask's purpose was to make the actor's voice vibrant and loud. Later, people came to use the term person to refer to the masked actor himself. In view of the above, it is quite understandable to associate a person as a natural being of the human species. Now, I think that's really interesting and important to hear, because what it tells us is that the word person actually relates to a fictional entity, something that is placed upon a person, a mask. So it's something that overlays upon the natural person. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you what a legal person means in law. Now, you might be mistaken for thinking that a legal person is a human being. However, in law, it can mean many things. And it says the following. In law, a legal person is any person or thing, less ambiguously, any legal entity, that can do the things a human person is usually able to do in law, such as enter into contracts, sue and be sued, own property, and so on. The reason for the term legal person is that some legal persons are not people. Companies and corporations are persons, legally speaking. They can legally do most of the things an ordinary person can do, but they are not people in a literal sense, human beings. Now, I'm just going to stop for a second there. What it's telling us here is that something in law that is described as a legal person might not be a human being. It could actually be a corporation, because a corporation or a company is a person, legally speaking. Now, this is extremely important to understand, because it's telling us that in a court of law, a legal person can actually refer to a corporation. And therefore, if you went into a court of law and they asked you, are you this person, you might be mistaken for thinking that they're asking you if you are a human being, when what they could actually be asking you is, are you this corporation? And it actually gives us the contrasting definition here. Now, this is something to understand. When you read legal dictionaries, if they tell you the opposite of something, then you know that they are completely separate terms. And it tells us here, a literal sense person would be a human being. So a legal person is completely different to a human being. A human being is a natural living person. There are therefore two kinds of legal entities, human and non-human. In law, a human person is called a natural person, sometimes also a physical person. And a non-human person is called a juridical person, sometimes also a juridic, juristic, artificial, legal, or fictitious person. Latin, persona ficta. Juridical persons are entities such as corporations, firms, in some jurisdictions, and many government agencies. They are treated in law as if they were persons, while natural persons acquire legal personality naturally simply by being born, or before that, in some jurisdictions, juridical persons must have legal personality conferred on them by some unnatural legal process, and it is for this reason that they are sometimes called artificial persons. In the most common case, incorporating a business, legal personality is usually acquired by registration with a government agency. Let me just repeat that. Legal personality is usually acquired by registration with a government agency set up for the purpose. In other cases, it may be primary legislation. An example is the Charity Commission in the UK. The United Nations Sustainable Development Goal 16 advocates for the provision of legal identity for all, including birth registration, by 2030 as part of the 2030 agenda. Wow, okay, let's pick this one apart a little bit. So it's telling us here that you are a natural person to begin with. We are all born natural people, but then we go on to acquire legal personality. Now, that should raise some eyebrows, because you are not naturally put into a legal system. You have to be put into a legal system by being somehow placed within it. And it says here, legal personality is usually acquired by registration with a government agency set up for the purpose. Now, I would posit that the last name is how we are put into the system. And I think historically that has been shown to be the case. And I think legally now we are getting to that conclusion also, that the last name is how we're put into the system. Now, once we are put into the system, we acquire a legal identity. And it's not just the birth certificate. People often mistakenly think online, oh, it's the birth certificate that does it. No, the birth certificate is just one document that puts you in the system and gets you to assume the legal identity with the all capitals last name. But in actual fact, it's simply being put into the system, being given a last name, and you adopting that last name and using it. That is what creates the legal entity. So you can have a social security card, you could have a driver's license, a birth certificate, a marriage certificate, all of those things put you in the system and give you this artificial legal fictitious person. That is why the last name is so important. However, you can have numerous legal entities that represent a legal fiction because you might have a variation of your last name on one form, you might use a middle name on the other, and this has been proven in a court of law. So long as you adopt the identity, you can actually have numerous legal fictions. And every time you present your driver's license, they will say to you, "Are you so-and-so?" And they will use the name on the card. They'll say, "Are you John Henry Doe?" You say, "Yes." Now they know that you are the legal entity. They're contracting with the legal entity, and that's why they can impound your car, because your car is not owned by the natural person. It's actually owned by the state, and you've got beneficial ownership. So what we're getting at here is that from your birth, you are immediately thrust into this system. That's why the birth certificate is important, but it's actually the name. It essentially turns you into a corporation. Rather than allowing you to keep your natural rights because you are a natural person, it turns you now into a legal person, a fictitious person, much like a corporation. So I'm certainly not surprised that the United Nations are seeking by 2030 to ensure that everyone has legal identity and everyone has birth registration, because it's through that birth registration that you get your first opportunity to adopt a cognomen. Remember, it's your Christian name that is your true name. The surname is used to create this entity that can be taxed, that can be fined, but also can be put forward as the debtor for the national debt. So the central banks require the countries, the nations, to put forward collateral. And of course, that's why you're registered in the system and you're put in the role as debtor, and you must pay back for your entire life through excessive taxation, the national debt, which of course is created with fiat notes that are backed by nothing, but there is interest attached. That is the scam system. So I think this is how it's working, but I'm not 100% certain on any of this. We're just speculating. We're scratching around in the dark and we're trying our best. But I think we're getting somewhere and I think we're on the right track. Now, just to put a fine point on this one, you may not know this, but many things can actually have legal personhood. It's not just a human being who can be put into this system and ascribed legal personhood. And it's not just corporations. The United Nations is in the system with legal personhood. The EU, temples, even rivers can become a legal person. The Whanganui River was granted legal personality in March 2017 under New Zealand law because the Whanganui Maori tribe regard the river as their ancestor. So the first distinction we have to make is between this legal fiction, an artificial person, and the natural person. You need to really drill that down, that unless you are being seen as a natural person and not an artificial person, you do not get your natural rights. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that having your legal rights and having a legal fiction for you is all bad. There's certainly good things about it too. You get the benefits. So, for example, if you didn't have your legal fiction, if you didn't have an artificial person for you, you couldn't get your state pension. You couldn't get all of the benefits that come with that. You wouldn't be able to open bank accounts. You wouldn't have legal protections of certain types. But also, there are obligations too. There's obligations because you can then become a citizen of a country. And when you're a citizen, you can be sent to war. And also, like I've said, you can be made liable for the obligations of the nation. You can actually be used in bankruptcy as somebody who is liable for the debt. You can be turned into a debtor. And then you've got to try and turn yourself back into a creditor, because the debtor doesn't get to keep all of their assets. And that is why they're registering all of the assets that we think we own in their own name. We only get beneficial ownership. The concept of legal personhood for organizations of people is at least as old as ancient Rome. A variety of collegial institutions enjoyed the benefit under Roman law. The doctrine has been attributed to Pope Innocent IV, who seemed to at least have helped spread the idea of persona ficta, as it is called in Latin. In canon law, the doctrine of persona ficta allowed monasteries to have a legal existence that was apart from the monks, simplifying the difficulty in balancing the need for such groups to have infrastructure through the monks who took vows of personal poverty. Corporation. The dictionary defines corporation as a number of persons united in one body for a purpose. Corporate entities date back to medieval times, observes Columbia Law professor John Coffey, an authority on corporate law. You could think of the Catholic Church as probably the first entity that could buy and sell property in its own name, he says. Indeed, having an artificial legal persona was especially important to churches, says Elizabeth Pullman, an associate professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Having a corporation would allow people to put property into a collective ownership that could be held with perpetual existence. So it wouldn't be tied to any one person's lifespan or subject necessarily to laws regarding inheriting property. So what she's essentially saying here is that the idea of corporations came about so certain entities could retain ownership over land and property forever. Forever, so in perpetuity. So even if laws were created that stopped a person from passing on property forever, so for example, tying up land forever in one family, this would allow them to get around that, and it's called mortmain, which means the perpetual inalienable ownership of real estate by a corporation or legal institution. And it says here that during the Middle Ages in Western Europe and countries such as England, the Roman Catholic Church acquired a substantial amount of real estate. As the church and religious orders were each recognized as a legal person, separate from the office holder who administered the church land, such as the abbot or the bishop, the land would not escheat on the death of the holder or pass by inheritance, as the church or the religious orders would not die. The land was held in perpetuity. This was in contrast to feudal practice in which the nobility would hold land granted by the king in return for service, especially service in war. And of course, this goes back to what I said earlier about the noble families of Great Britain. Well, they were actually of France, but they came to Great Britain and stole the land. They wanted to ensure they could retain their land, and that is where the surname came from for them. So it all goes back to corporate law, which of course goes back to maritime law. That's what we're talking about here. But in essence, it was the Vatican and the church who came up with this corporate structure. And just like the nobles, they had their problems with the King of England also, because they wanted to have their land forever. They didn't want any king telling them what to do. And of course, there was a time when the king actually signed over all of the property, all of the lands in England to the Roman Catholic Church. And he did this because he was suffering a rebellion. So the Pope said, great, okay, fine, we'll help you out. Only one condition. You have to give us everything. And that's exactly what he did. He signed it all away. So this is an important history to understand, but we can't get into it all here. So let's finish part one because we've got so much more to get into in part two. Slaves did not have legal personhood in Roman law. They were objects, not subjects under law. Still, their legal status was different from that of a thing. Whilst they lacked legal personhood, they could have legal capacity depending on the will of their master. The Institute's book in the compilations of Emperor Justinian I enunciated a fundamental principle. The primary distinction in law of persons is that all men are either free or slaves. The law of persons, therefore, must consider slaves even if legal personhood is not conferred on them. But they are no less human, for all that they are is not free men. This paradox can be explained by the strong conceptualization of Roman law. Slavery thus had dual legal dimensions. A slave's body is a thing. A slave had no legal personhood and could be discussed as merchandise. A slave could not have possessions, seek recourse in justice, or give testimony. He could not marry or legitimize his children. His master could freely dispose of him, sell him, lease him out, or use him, and had over him the power of life and death. A slave's spirit, on the other hand, is human. Even though he lacked legal personhood, a slave could have certain rights at the discretion of his master. A slave had a right to take a concubine if authorized by the master, and could freely manage any money given to him. This duality was also reinforced by economic practice. In theory, a slave could be subjected to extreme conditions since his master had the power of life and death over the slave. However, a slave was an asset and represented human capital, whilst the master could freely dispose of him. Now, I found that one really interesting. That's such an interesting quote, because when you read what a slave was looked upon as in Roman law, what you actually find is there are many aspects of slavery that actually could be ascribed to us. Because what it says there is that a slave can only have rights at the discretion of their master. So a slave had to ask to take a wife. Well, if you want to get married today, what do you have to do? You have to go and get a license. If you want to drive today, what do you have to do? You have to go and get a license. If you want to buy and sell, what do you have to do? You have to go and get a license. Everything that you want to do to function, you have to go and ask first. It also says here that the master could freely dispose of the slave, could use them as an asset, and also had the power of life and death over the slave. Well, as a citizen of a country, and we saw this recently in the news, you can be conscripted and sent to war. Now, what's also interesting is it mentions here that a slave was an asset and represented human capital. And I've got an article here from October the 23rd, 2020, and this was on the World Economic Forum website. We need to get better at measuring the value of human capital. Here's how to do it. Over the last few years, we've seen a seismic shift in how human capital is valued. COVID-19 added an impetus across the field. A rise in automation and artificial intelligence, growth of ESG and stakeholder capitalism, and an increase in intangible assets as primary sources of value, and an increased emphasis on employee well-being. It became clear that people are their organization's biggest assets. What remains, though, is to update the framework for valuing human capital to reflect this. A company's intangible assets include human capital and culture, and they are estimated to comprise more than half of a company's market value on average. Well, I can tell you for a fact that they are not talking about natural people there or natural persons. They're talking about artificial people. That is why they call them human capital, in much the same way that slaves were human capital of their masters. So I just thought that was an interesting link up, and I've found quite a few of these. But we must move on because we're coming to the end of part one. So I'm just going to finish by quoting from an article that discusses the all capital last name. The all capital last name, remember, this is the name that you are given on all of your legal documents. One of the foremost authorities on American English grammar, style, composition, and rules is the Chicago Manual of Style. The latest 14th edition, published by the University of Chicago Press, is internationally known and respected as a major contribution to maintaining and improving the standards of written or printed text. Since we can find no reference in their manual concerning the use of all capitalized letters with a proper name or any other usage, we wrote to the editors and asked this question. Is it acceptable, or is there any rule of English grammar to allow a proper name to be written in all capitals? For example, if my name was John Paul Jones, can it be written as capitalized John, capitalized Paul, capitalized Jones? Is there any rule covering this? The editorial staff of the University of Chicago answered, "Writing names in all capitals is not conventional. It is not Chicago's style to put anything in all caps. For instance, even if Gone with the Wind appears on the title page in all capital letters, we would properly render it Gone with the Wind in the bibliography with only the G and the W capitalized. The only reason we can think of to do this so is if you are quoting some material where it is important to the narrative to preserve the casing of the letters. We're not sure what context you would like your proper name to appear in all capital letters, but it is likely to be seen as a bit odd." So you have to remember, everyone, and I've said this already, but I'll just repeat it one more time. Law is extremely precise. Every letter, every punctuation mark, every capitalization in a legal document is utilized for a very specific purpose and reason. It has to be, and that is precisely why they use Latin. They use Latin because the word meanings do not change. The legal system is concrete. You can look in any document on style or grammar in the English language, in the English speaking word, and you will not find a single instance in which names of a person are all capitalized. There is zero recognition where that can be used. It doesn't exist, and therefore, it is a creation by those who enact it. So the people who are capitalizing our last names, which is of course the state, they have chosen to do this one. So where are we at now? Well, where we're at is they stopped using our Christian name. They stopped using our proper name. We still use it, but they actually ascribe to us the last name, the cognomen, if you will. And they do this immediately upon birth using the birth certificate, although it can be ascribed later on. And in part two, I'm going to tell you how that is done, for example, with people who migrate to a country. So immigration can ascribe a legal name to a person. It can create a legal fiction when that person gets to a country. So it's not just the birth certificate, it can be done in many ways, but essentially what they are doing is taking away your natural rights by giving you the cognomen, the last name, the surname, and creating a legal fiction. And when they create a legal fiction, they can then treat you how they wish. They can turn you into an entity like a corporation to be taxed, to be made liable for the national debt, to be turned into the debtor rather than the creditor. You can also be brought to a court of law and have all kinds of fines put upon you. You can have your property put into trust so you only get beneficial ownership, but they get true ownership, like what's happening with land in Great Britain, with the stocks and shares and bonds, which we've covered before. Now, like I said, there are many reasons why you might want to be a part of the legal system. You wouldn't want to be banished, for example, which is what happened in Roman times. You could get banished, where they essentially turned you into a legal non-entity. And that meant you had zero protection from the Roman state. You got banished and kicked out of the city walls. All of your property was confiscated because you essentially no longer existed. You was truly free at this point, but you was also free of any legal protections. So let's end this one on a few final quotes. Persons are divided by law into natural and artificial. Natural persons are such as the God of nature formed us. Artificial are such as are created and devised by human laws for the purposes of society and government, which are called corporations or bodies politic. So the argument here, everyone, is that the central banks, along with our governments, have created this fictitious trade name for us. They give it to us at birth or at a later date, and then we carry it around with us. And when we carry it around with us and we use it, we actually identify not with our Christian name, not with our first name, but with the cognomen. We identify with the surname, which is the legal fiction. So we actually accept it. And it becomes our property, and then we get to use it, we get to move around with it, we get benefits because of it, but we also get obligations as well. Your true name, on the other hand, which Black's Law Dictionary says is only the first name, that's your proper name, that's your true name. The other names are a legal artifice created by men to use within man's law. And one final quote here, accepting any benefits or privileges from the state or of the state, subscribing to an adhesion contract or forming an implied contract between an individual and the state, or even executing a unilateral contract of gifting rights or property to the state, generates a contractual nexus. As per the maxim of law, it is immaterial whether a man gives his assent by words or by acts and deeds. So what it's saying there is that if you accept certain benefits from the state, for example, a stimmy check during COVID, you are actually entering into contract with the state. And you can do that implicitly without you even knowing about it, because it says here, it is immaterial whether a man gives his assent by words or by acts or deeds. So if you accept something from the state, any type of benefit, then you are entering into contract. Of course, that would reassert the legal fiction. That is you accepting the legal fiction because they send you a letter or a check in that name. Okay, so we're going to leave it there for part one, everyone. I've got so much more to get into in part two. We are just scratching the surface on this one. I could make 10 episodes on this one, but part two, we're going to begin by looking at some examples of people who don't actually have a surname. They have not put themselves in the system, and we're going to start with the royal family. We're going to also talk about the Rothschilds, and you are going to find out what it looks like if you do not accept a cognomen, if you have managed to keep yourself out of the system. And what this really does is drive home the point that it is these legal constructs that we are being given from birth, using the last name, using the cognomen, that is actually the key part of the puzzle, particularly the last name. And I think this is just really going to be a primer. We're going to do more episodes in the future around this subject, but part two is going to blow you away. It's extremely interesting once we do those contrasts with people who refused a last name. Just like I said earlier in the episode when I talked about how the Ashkenazi Jews refused the last name, well, some people continue to refuse the last name. And that is a big red flag that maybe we are on the right track here. So if you are a member, please log in at parallelmike.com. If you are not a member yet, please consider becoming a member. Like always, I hope you are well, healthy, and reasonably happy. And we'll see each and every one of you in the next one for episode number 53.
what you are basically. Deep, deep down, far, far in, is simply the fabric and structure of existence itself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
Honestly expressing yourself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
The fabric and structure of existence.
Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.